This is a download from the BBC. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radiowales.
Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered. It was the unlikeliest of friendships, the former IRA commander turned peace builder and the preacher who'd spent decades denouncing all that he stood for. The Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley died 2.5 years ago, and thousands kept vigil this week for the funeral of Martin McGuinness. Their evident ease in each other's company earned them the astonishing title The Chuckle Brothers, an unrepeatable political double act. Now that they're both gone, we'll look at how much is still to be done in a part of the United Kingdom only too familiar with the kind of terror which struck Westminster on Wednesday. How divided does Northern Ireland remain? And with more than 40% of people still attending worship regularly, how are the churches handling the new reality? I'm joined by three guests. In a Belfast studio is Dr. Gladys Ganiel, a research fellow in the Senator George Mitchell Institute at Queen's University, Belfast. With her is Padraig O'Toole, poet, theologian and leader of the peace and reconciliation organisation, the Corrymeela Community. And on the phone from Bangor in County Down is the Reverend Brian Anderson, Methodist minister and vice president of the Irish Council of Churches. Welcome to you all. Let me start with you, Gladys Ganiel. The origins of the divisions in Ireland and in Northern Ireland go back a very long way, and we're not going to rehearse them in detail at all. But very briefly, how did religion come to be seen as a defining factor in the big divide?
Well, I mean, that's a centuries-old question. I suppose the colonial enterprise, starting in the early 1600s with the plantations directed by Elizabeth I, and when the majority of settlers who came from Scotland and England brought with them a Protestant form of religion, whether it was Presbyterianism from Scotland or Anglicanism from England. And the overlay of that Protestant religious identification with, I suppose, the social and political power they brought to the encounter with the native population that was Catholic, sort of, I suppose, set a precedent for an alignment of ethnicity and religion that would form the basis of the divisions for centuries to come.
And how much does this continue? I mean, we are very familiar with the perhaps simplistic definition, Protestant equals British equals Unionist, Catholic equals Irish equals Republican or Nationalist. I mean, to what extent is religious affiliation simply a means of identifying tribes, or has the substance of the religious disagreement been critical in itself?
I would say to an extent, the substance of religious belief and identity has been critical at certain points in Northern Irish history. So, for example, key theological ideas from the Calvinist tradition, say on the Protestant Unionist Loyalist side, ideas of, I suppose, being a chosen people traveling to a promised land in a covenant with God, that this land would then be theirs. You know, sort of ideas like that have helped form the content of identity and belonging for the Protestant community. On the Catholic side, there have been, I suppose, identification of Christ as an innocent victim and linking that to, you know, a felt oppression during the colonial enterprise. So taking religious ideas and melding that into an ethnic political mix have helped to create a substantial identity, as it were, in which other issues of politics, ethnicities and inequalities are tied together. But there are, I suppose, key religious ideas that over time have contributed to the formation of those identities. And particularly during the Troubles, a lot of social scientists would have said that we maintained artificially high levels of religious observance here in Northern Ireland, in part due to church going being seen as a way of identifying with your community. So in a sense, Northern Ireland was an outlier in Western Europe in terms of the very high levels of religious attendance. And, you know, some of that, I think, can be linked to this idea that it was a marker of communal belonging.
Yes, I'm wondering, Padraig, to what extent church attendance itself unavoidably became a political act.
Yeah, I mean, to go with your community to hear a story that your community considers normative and formative, both a religious story as well as the story of the community telling themselves their story, that's always going to play a very powerful force in asserting a sense of belonging for people. And that sense of belonging can be extraordinarily powerful and very, very soothing and comforting. I suppose for some people, when they're out in their work, they may be concerned about something that's going on, but they may be working in a mixed workplace, and so they may not feel like they could speak entirely openly with their colleagues, but perhaps at a place where they thought, well, most people here think the same, they would be able to speak in that way. So it isn't only religious sense of belonging that people have, but also a social sense of belonging. And that, I think, is the same in many places, but Northern Ireland just added a very particular dynamic to that.
And would that have been your experience growing up as a Catholic?
So I'm from Cork on the very south coast, and so where I'm from, just about 99.9% Catholic. So I moved to Belfast about 15 years ago. But certainly I grew up primarily hearing one particular viewpoint on the north and having that. And when I moved to the north, it needed to do a lot of work to make sure that I had friendships where I was able to hear other narratives.
Brian Anderson, how was it for you?
You know, I'm from Belfast. And I grew up in a predominantly Protestant area, so a different area to where Padraig grew up. And certainly I concur with Gladys and Padraig and what they're saying. My identity was a Protestant identity. Yeah, I didn't really have any significant Catholic relationship until I went to theological college. And I was 24 when I went to theological college. So my identity was very much in that Protestant church-going, sport-playing, unionist, 12th of July orange culture.
Yeah. And would you say that that was pretty typical for people of your generation?
Yeah. I'm a child of the 60s, so I live with the Troubles and grew up with the Troubles, and it was very much a sense of being with your own.
Because, I mean, a great deal has been made of, I've already referred to it, this friendship between McGuinness and Paisley, and people are saying this is astonishing, and I'm just wondering how exceptional it was, really. Patrick?
It was quite exceptional. I mean, I think it was notable that for both of them it came from long careers, both in religion and politics and other things, where they were coming from one way of being into almost like a conversion, some new way of being that was to the surprise of many within their own community and many from a different part of the community also. So, I know that there are times when people would have said to me as a Catholic leader, I'd like to be seen with you, but it's going to be awkward if we meet in a public place because some people might see me as being with you as endorsing an ecumenical viewpoint that my denomination would feel compromised by. And so those dynamics do still go on. Religion and politics are still very close to the surface here, and religious leaders do continue to carry an enormous amount of public expectation on them to not fraternise with viewpoints that are perceived to be different than what would be considered the correct ones. So the fact that McGuinness and Paisley had such an extraordinary personal public relationship, as well as seemingly finding ways to cooperate with each other politically, it was an extraordinary era.
And I think something that was especially remarkable about their relationship that is somewhat known but not that widely known is that Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness would actually pray together sometimes. And when you think of some of Paisley's previous theological statements, which were quite anti-Catholic and probably would have precluded praying with a Catholic, to, you know, just have that image in your mind, I think is quite powerful, perhaps even transformative.
It's that small linguistic change to praying with instead of what previously might have been said, which would be praying for. And there's something about coming alongside that was a genuine, remarkable change.
And it was a genuine friendship as well. Somehow the two men found a way to really appreciate each other and to be very much involved in each other's lives and to have a friendship. And I think that added to the optics of it all, the visible side of Reverend Ian and Martin McGuinness pulling together.
I'm wondering how far the divide has diminished over the past 10, 20 years, say. What's your perception of this?
Well, I think it depends how you define what the divide is. Claire Mitchell, who's a former colleague of Gladys's, Claire said that there's conflict about what the conflict's about. And it's such a fine way of describing it. So it depends what you think. if part of the conflict is that it's difficult to have public optics of people from different religious points of view coming together, well, then that has diminished. There are fewer examples of things where, I mean, for instance, when Peter Robinson, there was the murder of a policeman, and Peter Robinson went to the funeral mass, and that was considered to be the right thing to do. It took a bit of time in order to get the right mechanism going, but that was considered the right thing to do. And in a previous generation, that wouldn't have been possible. But in terms of looking at even your introduction, there was the question about in a corner of the United Kingdom, you know, we're going to be looking at this. The question as to what do we call here? Is it Northern Ireland? Is it a corner of the United Kingdom? Is it the north of Ireland? Are people from here Irish, British, Northern Irish, or a combination of any of those things? Those differences are still very visible. And while there is the emergence of a variety of people from a variety of community backgrounds calling themselves Northern Irish, which seems to be trying to locate itself as somewhere in between the polarities of Irish or British, nonetheless, the divisions are still quite marked in that way, particularly in politics.
Brian, how have you found this?
Well, if I can just speak from the point of view of the Irish Council of Churches, the looking over your shoulder to see who's looking at you from your own community, you're not as aware of that, anymore. So we as an Irish Council of Churches seek to work with all the churches through the inter-church meeting, bring all the denominations who are associated with us together to look at common issues. So we've been looking at freedom of religion. We will be looking at Brexit. We have looked at the implication of migration. So we're taking issues that are common to all of us and seeing how the church can speak into that.
I mentioned at the beginning that church attendance is still far higher than it is in the rest of the UK, but it's nevertheless down dramatically from the late 1960s, when apparently 2 out of 3 people were in church every Sunday. How much is that a product of the wider secularisation of society throughout Europe, and how much is it, well, because of the end of the Troubles?
Well, I think that both of those dynamics are at play. But it's too simple to sort of characterize it as, you know, the Troubles have ended, so people have stopped their, you know, their communal identification through going to church. Or it's too simple to say it's just general secularization like the rest of Europe. I think one of the key dynamics at play is actually a liberalization. So in Northern Ireland, what you get more so than in other parts of the UK or Europe in terms of church attendance is people, they are more likely to go to church, say, once or twice a month than weekly as well. So there's more of a liberal attitude, I would say, about going to church, not feeling they have to go every week. So you have to read that in when you look at the religious attendance figures as well. And you also have surveys, I suppose, that have shown liberalization in beliefs. So particularly, I think Catholics, and this would be both in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, have much more liberal beliefs than what would be perceived as, you know, church orthodoxy. So you also have a more liberal faith, which again is in line, I suppose, with other European trends.
And to what extent do you sense, Brian, that the churches themselves have changed significantly in the past 20 years, apart now from the business of, you know, being prepared to meet with Christians of other traditions? Are there significant changes of outlook, approach, style of worship, whatever?
Yeah, I think there are. You still can find in most towns a full spectrum of styles of worship, from your high church liturgy to your Pentecostal, charismatic, freer worship. There is no doubt, in terms of congregation, we are older, fewer, and poorer. Poorer in the sense that the older tend to have a fixed income, and we're having to work on that. There are newer denominations, groupings come into Northern Ireland. I can think of the Vineyard movement, and they are mopping up a significant number of younger families and people in Northern Ireland. And I just think there is a secularisation. Gladys is right in saying the liberalisation of society means that there's so many choices for folks now, and faith isn't the one dominating thing that it was, say, during the Troubles.
And in the Catholic churches, Padraig?
Yeah, there is certainly a change in the dynamics that are happening. The recent public scandals about the Catholic Church's response in terms of its decision-making regarding the scandals of abuse has certainly diminished people's automatic granting of authority to hierarchical systems. And at the same time, that hasn't meant that people have entirely abandoned it, church attendance either. So that certainly has made an influence. I think questions too to do with the importance in the north of recognising mixed marriages and recognising that the legacy of the church in being cautious about mixed marriages was not a positive contribution and was in fact detrimental. And so more and more people are, as Gladys was saying, happy to take certain parts of the church's teaching, but not to judge whether they'll attend based as to whether the church would say that they are entirely faithful on all matters.
And are there significant numbers of young people still in the churches?
Unfortunately, we don't really have recent data that's capturing yet the fall off amongst the younger generation. I have a bit of information, I suppose, from qualitative research I've done, particularly amongst Catholics, and this would be in Northern Ireland and the Republic as well, that the younger generation is really falling off in terms of mass attendance and engagement with the wider church. I was involved in a research project a few years ago where we really struggled even to find young committed Catholics to interview. So I think there definitely is a sense that the younger generation may be much more secular than we are currently aware, and only future research is really going to reveal that.
And do you get any sense at all, Brian, that some of the rejection of churches by younger people is because they are unhappy about what the traditional churches have done in the past and the way in which, if you will, they've lined up four different sides in the conflict?
My sense of the young people is that the Catholic, Protestant, Unionist, and Nationalist divisions, they're not particularly interested in. I don't think it's as important to them that they're either Nationalist or Unionist. I think they see the world much bigger than maybe my generation did. In terms of connection with the church, it's one of the biggest challenges for us. But I will say this, those who are committed are much more committed to a gospel that reaches out to those with in need of love. So therefore, the wanting to reach out to those who migrated, those of marginal societies. There's a deep passion for a Christianity that is effective on the ground and not something high and pious.
If you just joined us, I'm Roger Jenkins, and this is All Things Considered on BBC Radio Wales, where today we're discussing how much the situation in Northern Ireland continues to change. There have, of course, been many reconciliation groups over the years, but Corrymeela is far and away the best known. Podrick, you're the head honcho. You in theory, you run the place. What's the appeal of such groups?
Well, there's two head honchos, I should be really clear. I'm half a head honcho.
Half a head honcho.
I think the appeal is a new way of doing things, certainly seeing that you can do old things in terms of exploring the Bible, exploring what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be reconciled, but to do that in a new way where you're likely to be doing that with a global mentality. So, for instance, at Corrymeela, we have a year-long volunteer program. So when people come to our programs or come to any of our events, they're likely to be sitting next to somebody from Kenya, somebody from South Africa, somebody from the United States, somebody from Vietnam, who may or may not be a Christian, but they are interested in being part of a Christian community that is exploring what is the contribution to peace and reconciliation in a society that needs to be moving closer together. And I think with young people that come to our programs, that seems to be a real appeal, that you represent in the room not just everybody who thinks the same. That, I think, is understood to be part of the previous problem. Representing in the room people who think differently and people who are within and without the Christian tradition, that there can be a sense of all of that contributing well to everybody's deepening of their ethic of reconciliation. And I think that certainly the capacity to have plural viewpoints, I think that contributes to a sense of interest, because young people, everybody is connected to a global culture these days. You don't have to go far to find somebody who disagrees with you. So if you can have religious spaces that are not frightened of having people who disagree with each other in that religious space, I think it can make it more trustable.
And some people might say, well, it's the 20 years since the Good Friday Agreement and so on, all sorts of changes have come. Are centres like this still needed?
Yeah, well, Corrymeela began before the Troubles, actually. So I think all societies have need for places that can help us to address the tensions and the fractures within our society and to pay attention to those, to pay attention to how religious groups have been complicit to the fractures that have undone us and continue to be, and then also pay attention to how religious voices can be healing and can continue to be.
And Brian, where do you sense healing most needs to take place?
Oh, it's a complex, difficult question. Those who were affected by the Troubles, some have made journeys, some are still finding difficulty in stepping beyond what happened to their community or their family. And so therefore we've got to allow space for people to find that healing journey, and they are the dictators of how fast or how slow that goes for them. Corrymeela and other places are great at helping people move along in their journey. I think the churches do have a role to play. We have to hold our hands up and say that sometimes we didn't get it right and confess to a sin. Then also, we also doesn't mean we can't be part of helping people move along the journey of healing.
And I would like to add that I think one of the most significant aspects of this is that Northern Ireland, unlike a lot of other places that have had a violent conflict, has never had, I suppose, a public government-supported process for dealing with the past. And that has created a situation where, you know, whenever there are anniversaries of key events, key tragedies, these will be remembered, whether in the news or by people in communities. And it's sort of just like picking at a wound every time this happens. And as there's been no kind of public process of truth or accountability or even public grieving, recognizing people's mutual hurt and pain, this really just continues to keep things festering. And I mean, I think some sort of public process
something like a
would
peace and reconciliation commission are you talking of? Yeah, I mean, the South African type of model.
It's a complicated idea.
But I don't think anyone in Northern Ireland wants a South African model. That's people have been surveyed to death asking them that question. They don't want exactly that, but people do want something. And whenever Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan, the American diplomats, were here a few years ago, they came up with yet another blueprint for dealing with the past. And there were scores of suggestions there about how that might be done in terms of capturing people's stories, oral histories, reparational type situations. You know, we've got the suggestions there. The implementation of that, I think, would be very helpful for healing at all levels, from the societal to the individual.
Padraig?
Yeah, I mean, I think South Africa is so vast and Northern Ireland is so not vast that simply the geographical differences between here and there mean that something where you're going to be hearing somebody's public confession, perhaps in a South African style Truth and Reconciliation Commission, means you might bump into them the next day wandering into the town. And that certainly adds to a huge complication. There was a commission for reporting the past set up and sponsored by government, and their report, which was in excess of 100 pages, was quite extraordinary. And I think it's fair to say that the report fell on the fact that they were asked to make a recommendation of reparation to families who'd been bereaved, and they made a recommendation of no matter how it was who your family member was fighting for when they died, or if they were fighting, that all families would be paid an amount of £12,000, which highlighted for some people to say, well, my family member was innocent, but the family member that we're speaking about here, they were guilty, so that family shouldn't be getting a payment of £12,000. And to remember is a very painful thing, because it brings the past into the present, and we do not know how to deal with the past in the present. We don't even have a public commemoration once a year. The group Healing Through Remembering choose June the 21st every year, the longest day of the year, as a day for remembering the past. And they have all kinds of suggestions about how small community groups can do civic remembering in their local places. And so they're hoping to build a kind of from the grassroots representation of remembering the past up. But it remains to be a deeply divisive thing. Emily Dickinson said, "The past is such a curious creature." And she's so correct. It is a curious creature for us.
But it's something that we must deal with and find a mechanism of doing it at governmental and at individual level. We're presently without an assembly. we've just had an election. They're probably more polarised than they were before. And part of the problem is we cannot deal with the legacy of the past. And then I think the discussions and the reflections on this week, as with Martin McGuinness's passing, all of us have, you know, done some soul searching about our attitude towards this enigmatic man who, you know, started with one thing, and as has been said a few times this week, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And certainly it's my view that he finished as a peacemaker. But he's had, his death has asked of us all poignant, difficult, soul-searching questions.
A last question. Northern Ireland's often held up as a warning of what can go wrong in a society, but what does it have to teach the rest of us? Gladys.
Well, I tend to look at Northern Ireland as an example of hope in many ways. I know there's still a lot of cynicism and disappointment with the political process, and that a lot of people would say, well, we haven't made as much progress as we should have. But again, going back to the examples of Paisley and McGuinness that we've been talking about today, when you look at where they started and where they ended up at the end of their lives, that's just remarkable. And I think that what that shows you is that over a period of years, over a period, people trying to build relationships, to engage constructively, even, you know, to draw on their own faith, to do that and to use religious resources to cross boundaries, that, you know, change can happen, transformation can happen.
Brian?
Yeah, absolutely. To see Christ in the other, I think maybe part of our mistake was we didn't see an equal human being. But I think now we do. We see, you know, see Christ in the other person. You see a light in the other person, and we're all equal in the sight of God. And that sense of a common humanity, and respect, and learning to live with each other side by side.
Padraig.
I think Northern Ireland is an extraordinary example for all kinds of places that have distressed relationships with borders, where some people like the borders they have and other people don't. I think Northern Ireland is a place where we have recognised that within borders there's the capacity to move towards sectarianism, and we've been moving away from it. And I think that's more relevant than ever in a world that seems to be very committed to moving further and further towards sectarianism on both a civic and community and faith level. We have all kinds of responses here where people have crossed internal borders and significant borders to move towards each other, and I think that is more relevant than ever. And I think one of the other wise lessons that Northern Ireland has is that there is no easy magic answer to community division, but there are ways within which entire societies can make themselves virtually unrecognisable within the space of 20 years.
Padraig O'Toole, Dr. Gladys Ganiel, and the Reverend Brian Anderson, very many thanks. You can listen again to this programme or download the podcast via our webpage at bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales. All things considered, we'll be here at the same time next week. But meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.